netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Hi, and welcome to the FX Podcast. I'm John Montgomery. Our subject today are the special effects, not visual effects, of this series, Landman. Now, those of you who are regular listeners of the podcast know that we occasionally like stepping out of VFX and exploring other parts of the production, especially when it involves blowing stuff up. Our guest today is Gary Elmendorf. He's a veteran special effects supervisor with over 50 years of experience on feature films and series, including one of my favorite films when I was growing up in the 70s, which you'll hear at the start of the conversation. Elmendorf breaks down some of the practical effects sequences that are signature moments of the series. This includes a complex airplane crash sequence involving a fabricated King Air to rig explosions featuring over 2,000 gallons of pressurized fuel. You'll hear some of the meticulous planning, safety protocols, and creative problem solving needed to pull off these large-scale practical effects. So let's go ahead and cross that conversation now between Mike and Gary.
Gary, tell us about how you first got involved in the project. Because, I mean, I really appreciate you doing this. It's great. Thanks.
Well, I've been doing all of Taylor's shows for the last 7 years. I started on the first season of Yellowstone. And then I did 1883. I did both seasons of 1923 and Landman in between. Did Landman and then the last season of 1923. So the last 7 years, it's been taken up by all of those shows.
Sorry, go on.
Yeah, but I'm, you know, this is 50 years that I've been doing special effects. I started in the mid-70s on Logan's Run.
I love that. I absolutely adored that, Joe.
Yeah. It relaunched. It launched all of the special effects genres after many years of doing no big features in LA.
Yeah. So in this show, which is been really well received. If we just start with, I guess, episode one, there's like quite a lot going on from an effects point of view. In fact, probably more than I actually expected, and certainly not less than I hoped for. It was great. Was it always intended that you'd have such big sequences in the opening, or was it like, was this as scripted?
There are very seldom in any of Taylor's shows any colored pages.
Okay.
It's a script, and you shoot what he wrote. And especially if he's involved, and he was involved with the first two episodes. So, yeah, everything was in the script, and but not everything was done in anything resembling chronological order. I mean, we didn't get to some of the explosions till well into production.
Well, let's start with the plane crash sequence. I've seen the camera takes of the different cameras that were kind of filming that raw, and it's remarkable how close the physical effects seem to be to what was ending up in the edit. What's the relationship between special effects, visual effects, and like how did that kind of get mapped out?
Well, I don't believe there's any visual effects in that sequence. We built the airplane from seven different pieces of junk. the truck, we fabricated all the roll cage and safety features to it. They bought the original airplane, which was not the right airplane. It was always supposed to be a King Air 350, which is a much bigger airplane than the 100 they bought. So I had to cannibalize the nose section off that 100, and we found a tail section off of 200, which is a T-tail. The 100 is a conventional empennage. It's you know, a fin and an elevator and rudder. So that didn't work. Plus, you could really tell the difference between a 200 or a 100 and a 350 because there's like four more windows. Basically, okay. They're all the same. Fuselage stretched out, they extended the wings. So We took the nose cone off the 100, put it on the front of the tail section of a 200, used the fuselage sections where the power units are, and then because they were the only set of wings available, we put the 100 on the 200 because they all fit, and then started finding pieces to fill in where we could, and then we fabricated the rest of it. So we transported it in 4 or 5 pieces. And so after they landed the airplane on the highway and did all of the bits and pieces of acting, then that was one day.
Right.
And then they
flew the actual plane, not the one that you built, right? Yeah.
That's correct. And they flew that out of there, and that was on a Friday. And we had from Friday to Monday to bring in our airplane in pieces and assemble it on site on the highway. Used a couple of large tow trucks with a boom. We had already pre-assembled pieces. We built the whole airplane, had it painted, disassembled it, shipped it out there.
So when I've done work from a visual effects point of view, working with special effects guys on explosion sequences, quite often it's been necessary and to sort of pre-vis this up, especially the size of the explosions, because the camera setups need to kind of frame on something that isn't there. And I'm presuming you didn't have multiple takes of this, so you want to know kind of what you're going to get. So was there any pre-vising for blocking and stuff? Or I mean, you know what's going on, but for everybody else who's trying to sort of capture that on film.
Well, by the time we got to the airplane sequence, we'd have done quite a few explosions. And like I said, I've been doing it for 50 years, so I could tell them how more or less the size and how high. And we had limited things like we had to keep it within the roadway. So basically, every piece that we blew up ended within a 90-foot radius. I told them the closest they could do was 120 feet from the airplane itself. And a lot of the parts of the airplane, even though we assembled them, we kind of just barely held them in place. So for the timing, it was a trip connector. So the truck actually had to hit the airplane before anything exploded. And after that, then we continued the explosion. So there was no timing issue. The worst thing is on a truck going 50 miles an hour to try and actually time when explosion starts. So by making sure it had to make contact first, which I've done many times, then once you have a fireball, who knows how long it's supposed to take to do the rest of it. So the first fireball was in the wing section. And then the T-tail itself, which you saw once the landing gear was meant to collapse, was all on trips. The T-tail was assembled in such a way that it would lift off fairly simply, and everything stayed where it was supposed to.
For a cinematic kind of experience, 100% works and it looks brilliant. But I'm just curious, like, obviously you have a lot of control over the quality and characteristics of a flame ball, right? Like it's, and to the uninitiated, of course, you just assume it's an explosion of fuel. But of course, different fuels burn differently, different amounts of black, et cetera. Can you talk us through like what the actual sort of combustible material was? And was that like, how was that sort of ignited? Because again, you can't just blow up fuel. You have to like vaporize it to get air in it to ignite it, kind of thing.
Yes. Well, some of it, there was detcord, because it's fast and it gives it a little shock that initiated, but mostly it was black powder of different sizes. We used ounces here. I tried to do it so that there was within the engine pods was a small size. We also used a flammable peroxide called benzoyl peroxide, which is a dark, ugly black. burning material. And then inside the airplane itself, with the doors open, all the windows were removed, and it was a very thin plastic, so we weren't going to create. A lot of times, if you can find something, even with a small amount of pyrotechnics, it will exacerbate the size of the explosion. So you want to vent it and have complete control over how far and how much. So inside the airplane, because we wanted it quicker, we had like 3 gallons, single gallons of gasoline and diesel. I add a little diesel fuel to it. Gives a little dark black smoke. And that was ignited with dead cord, sort of on a clothesline, you might say. So
it, was, so it shoots it up and then ignites it? Is that how it works? Or
it vaporizes it right there. And if we already got an explosion, every single pyrotechnic has a flash bag next to it to make sure it ignites. So we vaporize it first and make sure that it flashes. So it's eight lines. So it's once the first one goes off, which is all by itself, and it's connected to that. And there's a dead man switch as well. If anything goes wrong on the way up and they call cut, until we push the dead man switch, nothing is initiated. So that's a safety thing that I've learned.
Incredibly important. And the truck itself, there are two things about that that interest me. Presumably somebody was driving the truck.
Absolutely. Yeah, an old friend of mine.
Okay, and so they were like, what, in sort of some kind of full pyro protective gear, I presume, like, because...
First off, there's a whole cage, roll cage.
Yeah.
Multi-layered, cross-braced, tied into the frame. And we added 2 or 3 different exit things besides the locations. Besides the standard door. And so that was all figured with stunts. And the driver's name is Danny Winans. And I've known him for 40 years. So he's a friend. So we make sure that he's safe.
Yeah, of course. And so then, Danny's driving it. And the thing that I wanted to ask you about is when it was coming off the road, I was like, I wasn't sure if it was meant to, but it like looked like you'd designed it so well that it was almost going to flip over because it was coming literally off the hard bitumen of the embankment.
Well, they didn't dig the embankment as deep as Stunts and I had requested.
Okay.
And there was 6,000 pounds of steel plate on that side of the truck. Both the truck and the trailer were counterweighted to that side. And they had been able, when he hit the airplane, his steering went away. So he was on the trajectory that it was, he couldn't get it to turn right at that moment.
Oh, so literally Danny, as a professional, couldn't turn it, you're saying?
Yeah, you know, he could not, for whatever reason, there was so much kinetic energy that he couldn't get it to, what he wanted to do was go through it and kind of make it whip and then flip it over. But it did almost go. And
I actually thought it was better that it almost went because it was like, I don't know, it just had this kind of sense of like, of course, in the story, it's fine, like they cut in and like the notional, fictional driver is dead. But I mean, it just, I don't know, it looked to me like the balancing on the side as it came off, I just thought was better than if it had just done a jackknife. But anyway.
Yeah, the fact that we did water the heck out of it, that ditch, and it gave. I thought it was cool to see that wave of mud flying all over the place.
Yeah, so, I thought so too.
And so, I had intended to also detonate the van, but at the end, we were running out of time anyway. And I thought it would look better and with more visual to see all the what was supposed to be the drugs flying all over the place.
Yeah, I was going to say, there's a really great bit where the van kind of spins as and the, it sort of spews out the drugs in a way that was like perfectly art-directed. I mean, if you'd been doing it digitally, you'd have like spent hours making sure that the audience could see the consequences of what had happened. So it worked out really, really well. Can I ask you this? Obviously, the number one thing is safety, right? Like, absolutely. But what's your biggest concern after that? Let's assume that that's number one priority and dealt with. Is your biggest, like, what is the, because you, if you, like, is it a timing? What's your biggest concern? Again, not talking just about safety, but like, what's the thing that's most likely to not work in a big stunt like this?
Yeah, it's timing.
Right.
And making absolutely sure that, we've checked every box on the prep of the, we make sure that we have enough amperage and voltage to get to the end of the line because we're 200 feet away. I mean, I think I haven't deleted a lot of it, but the people that were actually firing, I've got over some camera views of over their shoulder looking at the airplane and the whole thing. And the best thing is they know that when that first fireball goes off, they can just go.
Yeah,
and then safety is of course number one, but timing is the other, and then the ability to put it out once it starts. They enjoyed the explosion and the whole thing so much they forgot to say cut. They just kept rolling. So I finally I had to radio to my set guy that was up where they are because I'm at the airplane. I go, do you want to tell them to cut? Because there's not going to be an airplane left for them to film it, because it burned for probably 5 minutes and it was on its way out. So it's, they finally, cut.
I think the thing that I learned working, like as I have only alongside people that are like yourself that are really good, you need a really incredibly concrete, impregnable line of command chain. Like you can't have any ambiguity. Is that a fair reflection? It's like the most disciplined sort of line of command I've ever seen when you're doing stuff like this.
Yeah. And that's absolutely complete control of the set where everybody's supposed to be. And then in the case of Taylor, he's good about that. And basically he talked about we did all the scenes and everything else, but he at the last minute before he says he's talked about what we want to do, he turned the whole set over to me. And I was sort of unprepared because he says, I really don't, Gary knows what we're going to do, and he hands it off to me. Well, he hadn't really said what the sequence was, so I had Wade, the stunt coordinator, talk about the sequence of what we were trying to do. And then I said, okay, so when the truck does make contact with the airplane, here's what's going to happen, and this is where you have to be. And while we're loading it, of course, and getting prepared, everybody wants to see what's going on, and trying to keep everybody away from is, it's like, so I walk around going, you're not supposed to be here. You're supposed to be back over there. You stay within these parameters, and that's, I've been working with this group long enough that when I tell them something and they've seen what we've done, they listen.
Yeah. And look,
we've got a crew of 300-400 people.
Yeah. There have been incidents, I'm not thinking of anything in America. There was an incident in Australia where, people arbitrarily thought that they were far enough away from the explosion and odd bits of debris actually met the, because, you just assume that you know what's going on, but of course you don't unless you're a professional, and small bits of debris can be lethal. So yeah, absolutely. So can I contrast this now with the pump explosion? And the reason I want to contrast this is because on this shot, it's the first one with the jet, it's a wide, big piece of action, but the physical things that are moving are so big, right? So you need the camera back a fair way. You need to be wide. You need to be able to see the huge tanker, huge plane, like it's a truck, like it's all sort of big. The explosion at the oil rig, when the rig actually has like a kind of a blowback, that is absolutely as dramatic, but we now need to be much more aware of it at a closer distance, because instead of being like wanting to see this in a wide shot because there are all these big elements at play, there are meant to be three people that perish in the explosion. There's obviously somebody that's thrown clear of the explosion. Like it's a different problem, and one that did involve some visual effects, if I'm not mistaken. Wasn't Jacob on a green screen with wires and stuff?
Yes, but in the location.
Yeah, right? Absolutely.
Yeah, so they brought in a 20 by 20 green screen just for that piece of him being hand-pulled, actually. We had him on a dead man. Then that's the truck's reaction is timed with that. They exacerbated that in, they added to that in visual effects because it was hard to get in that location, get that kind of movement out of the truck as if it, but we blew out all the windows and all that was timing. We did it, I think, three times. That had multiples. But the pump jacks, you know, there are pump jacks. They were moved into place. There's a 60-foot hole. They're not really in the ground. We made our own pad. And I tested probably four or five different sizes of fireballs to know which size. So when we did the explosion, we did it in two separate pieces. We did it with them running up and doing all the stuff and did all the acting. And then we put mannequins in place for that portion of it.
So just to be clear, the three actors that are meant to be right around where the wrench effectively causes, I think it was a wrench, causes the problem that we later find out about, they are so close to that sort of ground zero that it's like, what, they're a foot or two away in theory, and they are replaced with mannequins for the actual explosion, if I'm following
you. For the brief moment where we have the explosion. And then that is a smaller explosion. That is a one that was designed to fill the frame, be very close to it. That is propane, benzyl peroxide, no gasoline. The propane poppers are of a certain size where they're like 5 gallons. And they're one of the largest. I don't think anybody else has them now. But I can predict how big exactly that fireball will be every time. So those are placed with a more controllable pyrotechnic in around the mannequins. Cut. It's over in less than 3 seconds, that portion. Then they pull back wide. And they're overlapped that with, I'm sure, some visual timing effects. But then we go to the bigger explosion with the pumped gasoline and diesel fuel. So we had 2,000 gallons at a time of diesel fuel and gasoline, and we were pumping it at 80 to 100 gallons a minute.
Because it has that real pressure hose kind of sense of it shooting up, not like it's just burning from a, I mean, it really feels like it's a, there's a lot of pressure to right. Which is, I guess, here we've got a slightly different problem because in the first instance, I've never seen a plane crash with a truck, with a whatever. But here, there obviously has been footage of, commercial oil disasters and rigs that have blown. How much were you kind of needing to keep your flames looking like that would be the real flames if it was happening, because that's out in the sort of, you know, YouTube or whatever? Or how much were you able to craft it just to give the kind of color and look that would be maybe more cinematic?
Well, I've done a couple of things similar before. I also have probably two or three Academy Award winning special effects people that, because I'm a member of the Academy, I've done feature films all over the place. I know one case, Tommy Fisher, he has done that oil well thing similar, a different place, a different size, a different. So there's a, there's two pumps, there's 2,000 gallons available. there's two pumps pressurizing what is more or less fire nozzles. We test them. There's one that's wide, and there's one that's more streaming. And when the explosion goes off, that's our ignition system. And then there's a burner that surrounds both of these nozzles that constantly feeds them flame so that the flammables always have a pilot. And then we also double plummet. So there's check valves and there's a separate pump that's pumping water. So when they yell cut, we switch from fuel being pumped to water being pumped, and
okay, that's clever.
Instantaneously. Yeah. It's done.
So we discussed that the actor Jacob, who's playing Cooper Norris, is separately filmed in front of a green screen for this jerkback sequence. By the way, you said that was hand-pulled. What did you mean by hand-pulled for that?
Well, in other words, there's no like pneumatic cylinder. There's no other things. It's literally three guys jumping off a ladder.
It's just like a seesaw effect, effectively.
They call it like a Chinese handball.
Right.
And it's what stunt guys do because it's hard to predict how exactly hard to pull someone. You can really hurt them. So by he had a limit line, and when he hit the limit line is when they go. And we did it. They did it. The part without any pyrotechnics under the van several times to the point where he was pretty sore, I think.
Yeah, I mean, this wasn't a stunt person. The actual actor was the person that was being pulled on the wires,
correct.
Right?
And he was game. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so now we've got that, and we've got him hitting the truck that, you know, that you said was set up to have the windows blown out and stuff. But what's interesting about this scene is, if I'm not mistaken, it sort of keeps going in terms of, am I right in saying that like some of the other cast, like Billy Bob Thornton, actually were sort of at that location going in front of flames? Because I understand that that was how it was actually filmed. Is that right?
That's correct. So we could stop and start this thing as many times as until we ran out of fuel, which was we had standby fuel trucks to replenish it. I have a certain formula that I always use for that kind of thing, gave it that nice black smoke.
Yep.
And we shut it off and restarted it, shut it off. And then I think it was the next day we came back with Billy Bob's portion of it, which is him walking right in front of the flames.
Now, how far was he away from it? Because, I mean, it's hard to tell. It could be on a super long lens. And
he walked by. He would have been like 40 feet away.
That's still pretty hot, isn't it, at 40 feet?
Well, it's all about wind direction. And in Texas, the wind blows always, especially this particular place.
Yeah.
So it's been very consistent. When we did the actual explosion, it did change direction really bad. And I had told the camera crew, if you feel, well, first off, I made sure that they did not put somebody in direct danger with a hand operated camera. I refused to let camera positions they wanted to use. I said, no, you can't do that. But with
in Australia, we call those Ned Kellys. I don't know if you know what that means, but
I know it.
It implies a steel drum with a slit in it that you can see the lens through, but otherwise no one's there. Yeah.
And, but I told the camera crew that was probably 150 feet away.
Yeah.
There are several of them. If you feel uncomfortable, you don't think, you don't analyze. If you feel warm, you turn around and you walk in what direction to walk. Don't think about it, because by the time you get through thinking about it, this thing is so hot. When it's going in one direction, it's not so bad. But if it changes direction, and in this area, it's notorious. So we have an aircraft style wind vane telling us what direction. And sure enough, during that one long run with fuel, the wind direction changed. It sort of, and that much heat makes its own little environment, and it turned and went towards the camera crew, and they did exactly what I told them. They just turned around and walked away.
Yeah, so no shots worth dying over. Yeah.
No, there is no. My family, my grandfather was a special effects person. He worked on Wizard of Oz in the 20s.
Oh, wow.
And the green smoke you saw is him. And he had retired, and he came back and to help them with something at 72. And the day he came back in, they walked into where they mixed all the stuff. It went off, and he was killed. So I know exactly.
I'm sorry, he was killed on Wizard of Oz?
No, this was in the 60s.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, with you. Okay.
Yeah.
I'm sorry to hear that. Yeah, I see. Understand now. Yep. And yeah, I mean, it's so walk me back now. So we've done that sequence which you just mentioned where that came around and the crew sensibly got out of the way. But now we're back the day after that, right? For Billy Bob Thornton's.
Billy Bob.
Yeah. And so you were saying he was about 40 feet from
in front of the, he says 12, but it was a lot more than that.
But it felt like 12, I'm sure.
Yeah. And, you know, he's in a turnout coat and things like that. So we modified what the original ask was, how far he went, where it was, because of the wind direction, it would have been too close to him. And then we bring in other flame elements when he's doing close-ups for what he's doing, but is not the big.
Right, because if it's on a close-up shot of him, why do I need to have another 40 feet of flame that I'm not seeing out of frame? Yeah.
At about 2,000 degrees, yeah. You don't want to do that. So, you know, it's all the cinematic probable, you know, what they call it, plausible deniability.
And, well, it's movie making, right? It's like whatever. Right. Yeah.
Exactly.
It's if it works on screen and it does, it's good. And just to sort of extend that out a little further, you then, when the cartel decides to do a bit of payback, you had another, I think it was meant to be, I don't know if it was meant to be one rig or two rigs, but there were like two big explosions that happened in a subsequent episode, right? And
yes.
Presumably you had to have sort of visual continuity to the first one. Sorry?
That's actually the same pump jack.
Oh, really? Okay. Well, of course, it makes sense. Now you say it out loud. Why would you build a second one?
Yeah. No, so we had, that's the other thing about how you do the explosion and how you, how long you apply heat to something. So we actually blew it up three times. And actually we, twice. But we actually had to clean it up, put it back together 3 days later because it was out of sequence. So we blew it up. We did the aftermath before we did the math, and they had a whole action sequence. So, that one basically was, they were blowing it up.
Yes.
So it wasn't like an accident they intended. So you have the storage tanks for the, oil, and you have the pump jack, which pumps out of that through different mechanisms and finally stores the oil in a tank. So basically we doubled up the exact same spewing oil and all of that and just did it again.
Yeah, but this one, apart from the fact that it was cinematically well shot, it felt different because I think in this one, naturally, the story had the characters further away from the explosion by just the nature of the script. And so there was sort of, to get them and the action, it was much more sort of like a wide shot kind of environment. Because I've got to say, that second sequence we discussed at the end of episode one, it just had this immediacy of having them right in it, which of course is what was required by the script, but it just felt very different. But it also felt very kind of, it just felt really tactile, I guess.
Yeah. We try to make it as real as we can. And the second one was much larger than the second sequence on a different episode because we had the oil tanks involved. So we, it was less volatility going up and more about multiple sources burning.
Yeah, I said one or two because there are two distinctive sort of fireballs. But of course, what they are, as you've just said, is the pump and the storage unit, which we didn't see. And also, as you just alluded to, there's not that sense of the high pressure shooting out of a well So it's actually, I mean, apart from visually working and everything else, it very much reads as a different sort of event. As you said, it's like more somebody blowing something up than a pump kind of blowback thing. But but they had to look the same for fuel reasons, right? I mean, we want to think that they're the same combustible material.
Correct. Yeah. So it, those things are the same elements, but it's much larger and it's less vertical and more about wide and trying to let it burn as long as possible for Stephen Kay, who was directing that one we're talking about. But unfortunately, some of the debris, which I was against, but was requested to do it, came down due to those constant winds into the field that's behind it. And now we have a brush fire. So we had to limit the amount of screen time we could keep it burning. And I believe that that's probably where they used, did some green screen work and put in the background from the first plate that we shot, because it ended up only being able to run 4 minutes, I think.
Yeah.
And they had a lot more dialogue to try and squeeze in.
Do you recommend overcranking on these sequences just in case somebody wants to either change it or play it slow-mo? I mean, is it just left up to whatever the director wants in terms of how the cinematographer
sets the shot? No, we discussed it. Like the DP in that case was, I think, Rob. And he's Canadian. He's been around a long time. And he wanted to know how fast the sequence was going to go. And we do silly little things like boom, 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 you know, and go through it, kind of a dry run. And I would slow down the truck sequence, but I can slow down the cadence of almost any explosion the way we do them. So literally sit there and go boom, 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 and then it's like, okay, that's what it is. And Stephen Kay has done multiple explosions. It's nothing new to him. So he's, you know, that's the good thing about having someone who's very experienced. And we've been lucky throughout all of Taylor's shows where we have directors that were DPs or directors that have been directors for quite some time. And that experience, and after several years, you know, trusting me, what I tell them is going to be happening. It's what happens.
Yeah, I really appreciate you taking time to run us through these, because they're not only are they like sort of signature pieces in terms of just action in the show, but clearly given the subject matter, they, you know, feature from the poster through to the kind of the marketing. But just before we finish up, were there other major sequences we haven't touched on that you were, you know, particularly fond of on this series?
Yeah, there's the sequence where the mortar rounds are coming in, where they're in the middle of the army using this as a test range.
Yeah.
The drug deal that goes down.
Yep.
And because they wanted them so big and wide, I would have liked to have done slightly bigger mortar rounds, but it's only a handheld mortar. It's not like a missile coming in, and it wasn't fired from the helicopter, which a lot of people got confused about. It's really the kind of thing that two men pick up and carry and drop in, and they shot that in. So so we sequenced it over a long distance to give them time to run and different things. And then there's nobody driving that van when it leaves. That there's 22 separate pyrotechnic elements in that. There's a cannon, car cannon, which is a plunge, you know, the 1500 psi through a 8-inch cylinder, and that's what launches the van. But so once you push the button, the rest of it is automatic. Different things trip themselves. And Taylor goes, I just want it to look really cool. I want it to look like a mortar round came in through the roof. So we had a cylinder that would pull down a section of the roof as it was flying up. So, you know, we built some fireboxes for the Sony A7s cinematic.
Yep.
And they were in the fire on every one of those shots we've talked about. So we built those out of a metal box. We designed them ourselves, and pretty simple thing. And they were bulletproof. So they scattered them around and said, where's it going to land? Well, it's going to go here, and it sort of give them a fairly tight target, but not that tight. And it looked really good, I thought.
Yeah, no, it did. It was really good. And also, you know, in the narrative, it was sort of unexpected. I mean, it had been set up, but it was like, you know, it was entertaining is what I should say.
Yeah. Taylor goes, I don't care what you do. It's just got to look cool.
Cool. Yeah.
okay.
Right? Yeah. Well, that's, you know, bums on seats for entertainment. Right. Yeah. And it's not as if the man hasn't got a pretty good track record for you know, doing these things.
Yeah.
His exceptional track record. Tell me, what is your general kind of relationship between special effects and visual effects? Like just professionally speaking on any production that you're working on, like how do you like to work and what's that relationship like?
I love those guys. I've grown up with them. I used to work at one place was called Video Image, where we did elements for them all the time. One of my best friends is a visual effects supervisor. Several of my friends on Hook, I ran the blue screen unit for all the flying and stuff, that type of thing, and all visual effects
in Queensland on the Gold Coast. That Hook?
No, the one with Robin Williams.
Oh, okay. Yep.
And in the 90s, right. And so because I've done enough of that stuff, I embrace those guys. That they're not taking my work; they're making some of it safer for us. I mean, we were doing tiny little wires on Hook, and now the stunt guys who do most of the flying in the States anyway, now we used to do it all. They can use whatever size rope or, you know, the modern spec wires that they want. So to me, visual effects is a very good tool, and it's a safety tool as well. Something that you really wouldn't want to put somebody, as in the case of the green screen when we jerked the actor, I wouldn't want him with that fire going on in the background.
Yeah. And the repeatability, you know, that facilitates, right?
Multiple takes. You know, that's what I like.
I don't know any visual effects person that isn't keen to be on set when special effects are doing stuff. And it's good to hear the reverse is also true, because I think sometimes in the popular press, there's made out to be antagonistic kind of attitudes between special and visual effects. I don't see it myself, and it doesn't sound like you share that point of view.
I won't have it. We're all a team. That's what I want it to be. I don't want any. This is mine. Leave it alone. No, we don't do that.
Gary, it's been just terrific talking to you. Thank you so much for taking time to go through it. Congratulations on the show. I know that it's been greenlit for another season, which I'm certainly looking forward to. Hopefully you'll bring some more magic to that one. But yeah, thank you so much.
Actually, the season is underway, and okay. I'm not the You're scheduling not on it? Issues and stuff. So actually, the guy that's doing it did the last Lioness. So the timing was better for him to do it than for me, because I had just finished 1923 and they were ready to go. So his work will be different than mine.
Yes. Well, you know, there you go. But again, thank you so much for taking time to talk to us. Really appreciate it.
Anytime. I appreciate it.
Well, thanks for that, Gary. We really appreciate you taking the time to chat with us and share details from a side of production that does often work closely with VFX. Well, that's it for this episode. For Mike Seymour, I'm John Montgomery. Thanks for listening.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.